You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hijinks at SCOTUS. Excuse me, SCOTUS. The Supreme Court has gone nuts. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is. It was a wild morning this morning over at the Supreme Court, most notably because Antonin Scalia just decided to go off, you know, and prove what people have been saying all along, that he's basically a political hack. The accusation of political hackdom with regard to this executive versus judicial branch debate was first made by conservatives about President Obama back in 2011, 2 years ago, when in the State of the Union address, he specifically said that Citizens United was not going to be a good thing, shall we say. Turns out he was right. Now, it had been ruled on in December of 2010. His State of the Union address was just a couple months later, and it was a little too early to tell. Maybe, maybe not. No, I don't think so. I think we figured it out. And Shane O'Farnon, our associate producer, was at the Supreme Court. He's also a Supreme Court reporter and a graduate of law school and all that kind of cool stuff. Shane, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And thanks for being here. I'm curious. We've got this rant by Scalia that he went off on, mm-hmm. and calling the president out.
It came out of nowhere as well. And when you're in the Supreme Court, you really can't make a sound. But you could look around at the faces of the people in the room, and they're like, this is odd. This is different. This is something we don't normally hear. And it was very pointed, very direct, very political.
Yeah. So paint the picture for us. Tell us what happened.
So we went in at, around 9:30, 10 o'clock. Court came into session right around 10. And this was my first time actually covering the Supreme Court, so I didn't know what to expect. Everyone stood up just like normal, court. The nine justices came in. First, they proceeded to do a ruling on Miller v. Alabama, which is a case about whether or not you can get mandatory life sentences to juveniles. Justice Kagan read that decision. Then Justice Alito had the dissent on that. He was quite rude, actually. He wanted
to throw the kids in the slammer forever, lock away the key, right?
Pretty much. And also he kept going on about how the majority opinion didn't think that the states knew what they were talking about, and he actually used the word stupid. The Supreme Court, the court today, thinks the states are stupid and can't put two.
Was he reading prepared remarks, or was he speaking extemporaneously?
He was reading prepared remarks, but we did not get a copy of his. We did get a copy of Justice Scalia's, which you have a copy of, which is amazing. Right. So then they proceeded to the next, and it was Justice Kennedy who read the decision. Well, not really read it, but his remarks on SB 1070.
Right.
And very methodical, went through the four different parts. And three of the four parts were ruled to be preempted by federal law. One was left and said, well, as it applies now, which is Section 2B, which is whether or not they could, essentially, once someone is arrested, can you check their immigration status? They're saying, right. Well, that really isn't preempted. We'll see how it's applied. It could come back here. So for the most part, it was overturned, and I'm sure everyone will spit it. However,
yeah. One way to say this is the papers, please law was overturned, all parts except papers, please.
Exactly. But as soon as it really hasn't gone into effect, so no one has been asked for their papers under this law.
Right. And if it turns out that the vast majority of the people who are asked for their papers have brown skin, then you're going to have a lawsuit.
Right.
That fast.
Equal protection, yep. Right. Then there'll be some Fourth Amendment things.
Civil rights laws.
But those cases aren't ripe yet, so they can't go for the Supreme Court because right. No one's been hurt by it yet. This was only on preemption, and it'll probably come back at some point. Then was the dramatic part, which was when Scalia talked about the Arizona case.
Right. And he said, shall I read some pieces of this?
Oh, please do. I was hoping to get the audio, but we cannot get that.
This is quite juicy. Just some excerpts. He says, after this case was argued and while it was under consideration, the Secretary of Homeland Security announced a program exempting from immigration enforcement some 1.4 million illegal immigrants. Notice he didn't call them undocumented workers.
Of course not.
Yeah. The husbanding of scarce enforcement resources can hardly be the justification for this. The president has said the new program is the right thing to do in light of Congress's failure to pass the administration's proposed revision of the immigration laws. Perhaps it is, though Arizona may not think so. And but to say, as the court does, now here he's arguing against his peers, but to say, as the court does, that Arizona, this is the Senate Bill 1040, 1070, whatever it is, contradicts federal law by enforcing the applications of federal immigration law that the president declines to enforce, boggles the mind.
That's a pretty good Scalia impression there, Tom. I like that.
Seriously? Really? I've never heard it.
He bloviates and
performs.
Oh, he does. And it's so frustrating, too, as someone who tends to, when I see public speakers, I tend to yell back, especially at my television. If I were to say a word, I'd be cuffed and out of there.
Sure.
So you have to sit there and be very quiet as they're pretty much, you know, speaking from the mount, it seems.
Yeah.
And he was just, and to see him, this was a political attack going after the president for his new immigration law, saying, see, this is why Arizona needs this law, because of what President Obama's doing.
Well,
and they went even further in the next segment.
Yeah, and this is our royal family, by the way. These are the, you know, mm-hmm. the Queen has the ability to dissolve Parliament. The Supreme Court has the ability to basically rule laws null and void. So anyhow, so he goes on, he says, so the issue is a stark one. Are the sovereign states at the mercy of the federal executive? That's fancy talk for president. The federal executive's refusal to enforce the nation's immigration laws? A good way of answering that question is to ask, would the states conceivably entered into the Union if the Constitution itself contained the court's holding? Imagine a provision inserted right after Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, the Naturalization Clause, which included among the enumerated powers of Congress, quote, to establish limitations upon immigration that will be exclusive and that will be enforced only to the extent the president deems appropriate, end quote. The delegates to the Grand Convention would have rushed to the exits from Independence Hall.
Incredible. So he's saying that states would not have joined the Union based on this decision.
Yeah, if not based on this decision, but based on the president's decision to selectively, shall we say, enforce the immigration law. And do I have it right?
Well, actually, what he's saying, I think there is saying this decision allows the president
to continue doing that, and so that wasn't before the court,
right? Well, if he's saying if you combine this decision with what the president did last week, the states would not have joined the Union, and that was his comment,
right
there.
Bizarre,
absolutely, without a doubt.
I mean, this is I think what he's talking about is the Articles of Confederation. I keep thinking that Scalia and all these guys, that what they want to do is they want to take us back to the pre. Small R Republican times, to the pre-constitutional times, back to the Articles of Confederation, when the states had enormous power, and the federal government had very little. So what happened after that?
After that, the Chief Justice said that the remainder of the decisions, namely the Affordable Care Act, would be Thursday morning, 9:30, and that was it. Everyone filed out quietly. And then we had the decisions for the press, and which I really liked. I liked having Scalia's bench comments
right
there.
Yeah.
Now I know why the Supreme Court doesn't want cameras, because they would have a lower approval rating than Congress.
Seriously?
That's what I think.
Why?
Really. Because if people really knew what really went on and how those justices act, at least I've only seen them once, and it was today, and I was amazed at the...
Behaving like children?
And just rude. Just nasty, even.
Really?
Yeah, I found Alito very off-putting, very off-putting, and he sits right next to Justice Kagan, who had just read the opposite side, the majority opinion,
right?
And he went right after her.
Wow,
not personally, but on her intellect at least.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I've always had this sense that these five conservatives are like, you know, kind of, hey, we are, well, they are. They're the royal family of America. They're the kings of America. And they know it. And they're loving it. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So more about the political fallout of this. And by the way, what Mitt Romney had to say, it's going to shock you right after this.
Thank God for the Supreme Court, modest and high-minded sort. Never would rule us from the bench, hit us with a monkey wrench. Except when it comes to appointing a president for a democratic nation. We're handing elections over now to monster corporations.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Okay, and this is Stephen Breyer wrote a dissent to this. Actually, I've changed topics here without letting you know. I'm sorry. Let me start over again. In addition to the case that we were that Shane was describing at some length here, the SB 1070, the whole, you know, Arizona papers please law, the Supreme Court also today did what I think is probably, I think history is going to look back and say that was really the most important moment. The Supreme Court back in 1856 ruled that people are property. It was, you know, Dred Scott versus Sanford, and in that case they ruled that slaves were actually the property of their masters, and that, you know, just like end of debate, okay? This is it. And arguably that 1856 decision of Dred Scott led right to the Civil War. And in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled the same, only opposite. Instead of ruling that people were property, in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled that property is people. And Citizens United, corporations, property, are the same thing as people. And it's just as bad a decision in my mind, and is taking this country just as close to a civil war. Well, perhaps that's a bit of an overstatement. I don't think that we're going to have a shooting war in America, although, I mean, tell that to the people standing around Gabby Giffords. But we'll see. In any case, I'm not expecting that, but dividing America, shall we say. The Supreme Court basically said, yeah, corporations are people, money is speech, you know, we've got to open this thing up. And so Montana has had this law for over 100 years. In fact, it goes back to 1897, as I recall. I've got the, yeah, here it is. William Clark was a copper billionaire. And it was 1899, and the Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana told us this story on the air a week or so ago here on this show, how William Clark, the copper billionaire, this is Anaconda Copper, I believe, or maybe it was a different name at that time, but you know, the copper was king in Montana. And back at that time, the way that you got into the United States Senate is your state legislature had to appoint you. Or that's at least that's how it worked in Montana. The federal constitution simply said that the states had to decide how they were going to send senators, and in most cases, the state senate or the state house and senate would simply appoint them. In the case of Montana, it was the state senate. And what William Clark did is he stood outside the legislature and said, or he said it right out loud, anybody who votes for me for senator will get $10,000. And he literally passed out envelopes with $1,000 bills in them to legislators after the vote as they walked out of the chambers in Montana. Now, this hit the newspapers, and it so horrified the actual United States Senate that Montana would do this, that when William Clark came here to Washington, D.C., the United States Senate refused to seat him at first. Said, sorry, you can't sit here having been, you know, bribed. And this is what, in large part, led to the passage of the 17th Amendment about a decade and a half later, which says that the citizens of the state will elect the United States senators rather than the state legislatures appointing them, because rich guys were buying their way into office. So Montana had this incredible history of seeing the impact of big money corrupting their legislature and corrupting their laws and corrupting even a United States senator, or vice versa. The United States senator, the guy who bought the Senate seat, corrupting the state. They were so clear about this that they passed a law over 100 years ago. They passed a law that said that corporations, like the big copper mine, can't give money to political candidates. That law, of course, is contradicted by the Citizens United ruling. The law was challenged by a right-wing group in Montana. And the right-wing group being the American Tradition Partnership. And it went up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said, hey, you want proof that this causes corruption, that money in politics causes corruption? And they gave this long list. It ran like 3 pages long of incident after incident after incident, all the way back to the 19th century, of legislators being corrupted by money. And they said, you know, and so the state Supreme Court said, we're going to let this law stand, even though the Supreme Court has passed Citizens United. We're going to let it stand because we can prove a harm. And in Citizens United explicitly says, quote, independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. End of quote. That's right out of the Citizens United ruling. What? You know, money, corporate money, hey, you know, as Governor Schweitzer said, what could happen? Right. Well, what could happen is pretty obvious. And John McCain, Republican, and Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat, signed on with Montana Attorney General Steve Bullock. This is an article by Benji Sarlin over at TPM website. To fight this thing. And the Supreme Court today said, this is sort of a non-ruling. They didn't actually rule on the case. They didn't hear arguments. They didn't hear debate. What they said was, we're not going to hear this case. And Stephen Breyer issued a dissent about that. Do I have this right, by the way, Shano? I don't. Okay, tell me what I'm missing.
They did. They granted certiorari. So,
right. But okay, so they technically heard the case.
Well, they did. They ruled on it just without hearing anybody, without any briefs, without any argument. They just said the Montana Supreme Court's reversed.
Right. Okay.
That's it. It's
okay.
Over.
Right. Right. And Breyer issued a dissent in this, and in which he seemed rather upset. He said, even if I were to accept Citizens United, this court's legal conclusion should not bar the Montana Supreme Court's finding made in the record before it that independent expenditures by corporations did, in fact, lead to corruption or the appearance of corruption in Montana. And he says, given their history and political landscape in Montana, they had a compelling interest in limiting corporate money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do you think we can best deal with this, and could this be the best thing that happened for the Repeal Citizens United movement? I think it might be. Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Michael in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, what's going on, sir? Hey, first time caller. I'm not sure your guys' stance on this, so that's why I wanted to find out. I just don't understand what the problem is of having local, I'm not talking about federal, but local law enforcement, like deputy sheriff or whatnot, enforcing federal immigration law.
Well, and that's arguably what the Supreme Court just ruled, is that there's not a problem with that. Or at least there's not a problem with determining the beginning point, I suppose, of it. I would say that the problem is that from the point of view of the police, and if you look at the police in Arizona, with the singular exception of Joe Arpaio, most of the professional police associations in Arizona and around the country are strongly opposed to this because they got enough to do already. I mean, they're dealing with robbers and bad guys and domestic disputes and bank robbers.
Well, if that's the case, then that's my question. If that's the case, then why should local law enforcement be enforcing any federal laws if they have too much to do?
To a large extent,
federal
they don't.
Federal drug laws, federal gun laws.
They don't. There are state gun laws.
The police don't enforce federal drug or gun laws?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no. They enforce state laws.
That's, I'm sorry, sir. You're very much wrong on that. Like if, for example, a police officer comes in contact with a sawed-off shotgun, they don't say call the ATF. They arrest the person for violation of federal firearms.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Excellent point.
So why, and that's what I'm saying, why can't they just, I mean, it's either one or the other, in my opinion. If they don't want to have them enforce immigration, that's fine.
Yeah.
Don't ask them to enforce drug, you know what I'm saying, like drug laws or anything like that. But if you do, then have them enforce it.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it plays out. I personally don't feel really strong one way or the other. I got to tell you, I understand.
I just think that if you're either all in or you're all out, there shouldn't be any half and half.
Well, it could be. On the other hand, it could be, up to the discretion of the states, which is, there's a lot to be said for that. And that's essentially, what Arizona's saying is, okay, we're going to say it's up to us and we want to have our police ask people for their papers to determine whether or not. Now, what the federal court ruled, the Supreme Court ruled today, is that the
you can't require, you can't punish people because they don't have their papers. So I'm not, you know, Shane, you heard the arguments there. Make sense out of this. How does a police officer say, what is your immigration status, and not say, may I see your papers, because the Supreme Court just said you can't be forced to carry your papers with you?
Well, they said that the essentially there was four parts of the law. The first one was Arizona made it a misdemeanor to not carry your papers. They're saying you can't make it a crime.
Right. So the state made a crime out of a federal crime.
Right. The only thing that still stood is whether or not you could check if the person was already arrested for something else, if their immigration status.
Right.
That was the only thing. And hang on one second. If I grab my notes, I can find the other.
And taking that to the case of the sawed-off shotgun, I think seeing that is a crime. That's not probably a good analogy. Go ahead.
Okay. First, it was the misdemeanor to not carry immigration papers, that was preempted, essentially saying the federal law already has that rule. You don't need another one.
Right.
Or they've occupied that area of the law. 5C, it's a misdemeanor in Arizona to seek or engage in work that's not authorized due to your immigration status. So, like, there already is a federal law on that.
Right.
Section 6 gives the authority to arrest someone on suspicion of being illegal. They pretty much said that is preempted because it contradicts federal law. It is not a crime, technically, to be in this country illegally. It's a civil penalty where you get a summons to appear at a hearing and then you're deported. It's not a punishable offense as a criminal offense.
Right.
They're saying that Arizona went beyond the federal law in that case.
By criminalizing it.
And the last one was 2B. They dealt with it last because that was the one that was not preempted, saying law as written doesn't conflict, but as practiced it may. But we don't have any cases of it being practiced because it hasn't been in effect yet.
Right. Very interesting. Okay. We will see how this plays out. Bob in Laguna Beach. Hey, Bob. What's up? Bob?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hey. Hi, yes, I'd like to call and weigh in on the Citizens United.
Okay, you're on the air. Please weigh in.
Yeah, very good. Well, obviously, the Supreme Court, by their ruling, has created a situation that most people are concentrating on the corporations controlling our democracy right now. But one of the things that I don't hear anybody talking about is how we could have some serious long-range implications by the, and only a couple people have mentioned it, how the foreign nationals and foreign countries might decide to dabble in American politics themselves. I would imagine that possibly it doesn't seem too far-fetched that the Chinese could be thinking about a 10 to 15-year plan to get involved in our own political process and by their own people to maybe get on major panels in the Senate and the Congress to control decision-making. They could even start dismantling our military system slowly but systematically by buying our political process. And if they can't take us over militarily right now, perhaps 10 or 15 years from now, they will systematically
just buy us out. They'll buy our politicians. Shelley Adelson, who single-handedly, he was Rick Santorum's guy, wasn't he? Or was he
Newt Gingrich's, moved over.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And thank you. Shelley Adelson, I mean, he makes his money in Macau. Macau is a Chinese territory, so it's Chinese money. And, John McCain was the guy who pointed this out.
He's an American who's using his profits from overseas. I'm talking about the actual governments of Red China deciding that they would like to put their own people in office directly, and they've got an unlimited supply of money to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas they could start.
All they have to do is set up an American corporation to do it. And you'll find, if you look at the people who are bankrolling, for example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, that there's a lot of Japanese corporations, Chinese corporations, German corporations. There's corporations from all over the world there that are right now putting money into the Chamber of Commerce, which is using that money to trash President Obama. So we're already there, Bob. We're already there. Henry in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Henry, what's up? Henry? No Henry. Okay. Ryan in Everett, Washington. Hey, Ryan. What's on your mind?
Hi there, Tom. I wanted to make a comment about Governor Jan Brewer. And actually, her, Marco Rubio, and a few others, I've been watching the news lately, and they have this talking point saying that President Obama had 2 years before Republicans took the House to do something about immigration. And it just strikes me to be unbelievable that they are pushing it that we should have done it, why they didn't have any skin in the game. And I don't know, it just seems like something that everybody should be nailing them on and saying, look, you guys, if you don't want to govern, don't get involved in government, because, you know, you are one of the votes, and we need you to make these laws happen.
Well, and the president had tried to change immigration laws, and the Democrats had tried to, including with the DREAM Act, and the Republicans just knocked them down. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Ryan. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, good work, Tom, and hope your wife's improving.
Thank you. She is.
Yeah. What's up? Hey, a couple things. I just want to be as cogent as I possibly can here. There's no royal family. I take issue with that. I don't regard, and a lot of people don't regard the Supreme Court as any royal family of the U.S. It's just a temporary occupation. That's what I want to say about that. And also,
well, I would say they've been
Montana
royal family
thing,
since 1803.
How ironic about Montana, in historically speaking. I mean, if you look back, I just want to mention that the largest funeral that ever took place in Montana, there's over 4,000 people at Frank Little's funeral. Frank Little was an Oklahoman, a labor activist of his time, went to California and then wound up in Montana and got murdered by the government corporate thugs and the mining industry. And it was the largest funeral in Montana history. It's ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, it was back in the era of Joe Hill, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, Bob, here's the thing. The Supreme Court is our royal family, respectfully. These guys, it all started in 1803. Thomas Jefferson, incensed about the decision. Jefferson coming out and saying, if this decision is allowed to stand, Marbury versus Madison, where the Supreme Court said that they have the power of judicial review, that they have the power to strike down laws passed by Congress. Jefferson said, if this decision stands, then indeed has the Constitution become a felo de se, a suicide pact, for it has become a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary to mold as they choose. And then he went on to point out that this is the unelected branch. And he and many of the founders felt very strongly. Now, there were some of the founders who felt that there should be the right of the judiciary, the Supreme Court, to strike down laws. There are others who felt not. And it was a big debate. In fact, you read Federalists number 78, 79, 80. We've got a clip from Newt Gingrich in our collection of Newt Gingrich talking about this, pointing out, you know, judicial review is wrong. Hamilton said so in the Federalist Papers. Well, he did. And then he also said, no, it's okay, in the Federalist Papers. So you can pick it either way. But the point is that this has been a debate in the United States for a long, long time that was settled in 1803. By the court, when they said, yes, we will be the royal family. Thank you very much. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the question, what do we do? I think we have to start out by amending the Constitution to say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. And then we can get back our country.
To be king for a day.
Well, how about king for the rest of your life? That's what happens when you're nominated and ultimately placed on the Supreme Court. You literally are one of America's royal family for the rest of your life. Jim in Denver. Hey, Jim, what's up?
I have two. One is privatized versus corporatized. Privatized is kind of a sterilizing euphemism for corporatized.
You're right.
I mean, you lose that vocabulary and strip the masks off the rats and call it corporatized.
Okay.
And what do you think about that?
I agree with you.
Yeah. And the other one is if money is speech, then a lawyer in a courtroom ought to be able to buy the jury instead of bringing them back by his rhetoric.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Yeah. If money is speech, why even have the defense lawyer or the prosecution stand up? Why not just have them see who can outbid whom with the jury?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if our jury system is analogous, it's the legal, the judicial equivalent of the legislative branch, you know, deliberative body, and the Senate is supposed to be the greatest deliberative body on earth. Why are we allowing our jury essentially to be bought? Excellent point. Excellent point. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Lewis in Seal, Alabama. Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. I'm a disabled veteran, and my constitutional rights are being destroyed.
Okay. How's that?
Okay. I was kicked out of my VFW for being Hispanic.
Really?
I had death threats. People call me the N-word, saying N-word. So I went through the chain of command of the VFW.
Right.
Okay. They didn't help me at all.
Right.
I get a lawyer through the NAACP in Columbus, Georgia. She gets arrested for fraud in the beginning of November 04 in a different case.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of November 04, the federal courts closed my case. I didn't find out my case was closed until April of 05. My attorney called me and said, Mr. Canales, you don't have to keep calling me.
Yeah.
Your case is fine. She didn't even know it was closed.
Right. Lewis,
I went back to the NAACP, and on a live radio program, the president, he tells me, just get over it.
Okay, Lewis, I'm sorry to give you short shrift here, but I don't know the particulars of your case, and we can't litigate it here on this program. You have my sympathy and empathy, but I don't know what happened, so I can't. Paul in Orange, Connecticut. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm a huge fan of yours. I've read a significant amount of your books, and
thank you.
I wanted to ask you, Tom. I'm sure you may or may not know that there's a huge, huge new scholarship trying to figure out whether what Charles Beard said was correct. And
which one of the things that Charles Beard said are you talking about? Probably would have been Charles and Mary Beard. They often wrote together. Are you talking about their book on the history of America that was published in 1928?
I'm talking about on the Founding Fathers, on whether they were creditors and whether they had a secret agenda. That subject.
Yeah, yeah. Charles and Mary Beard established in the 1920s this concept that the Founding Fathers were rich white guys who were establishing the Constitution for the benefit of rich white guys. And there has been some really good scholarship done since then. And I've written several pieces on this. It's a chapter in one of my books. I believe it's What Would Jefferson Do? It might be a threshold. Where the guy who wrote probably the best piece, and I'm sorry, it's been a number of years since I read this. I can't remember his name, but, you should be able to track this down using Tom Hartman and Charles Beard.
Tom, I didn't get to my question.
Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
Is that okay? Thank you.
Yeah.
There's a great historian named Woody Holton. I don't know if you read his book, Unruly Americans, Origins to America.
No.
And I'm wondering, I think you should read that book because all of his sources are actually letters between the Founding Fathers. And if I could quickly ask you a couple of small questions to see if you could agree with what he said. Do you have time for 30 seconds?
I suppose.
Okay, my first question is, would you agree that that the federal constitution was less democratic than all the state constitutions that they had during the Articles of Confederation? Do you agree with that?
I don't have any idea.
Well, that's one thing I would look at before making the judgment on whether or not the Founding Fathers, when they illegally ratified this constitution, didn't do it the right way. I think we should.
So you think that our constitution was not ratified legally, therefore we don't have a constitution?
Well, no, what I'm saying is, if you read authors like Harlow Giles Unger, I believe it was a coup d'etat. I believe it was a bloodless coup d'etat.
Yeah.
And this is after 20 years of research, Tom. I'm not some whack who's... See, I want to find out why corporations have people. And I've even... Another thing I wanted to talk about...
But at that point in time, the contemporary corporate form did not exist.
Well, the East India Company, and Tom, and this is one of the reasons I love you, because you're the only person who talks about the East India Company. We had a corporation ruling the world at the time.
Oh, yeah, of course, but it had been kicked out of the United States, and every single state in the union required corporations
to
dissolve themselves within 20 to 40 years.
Your own book says that the East India Company was working with the Founding Fathers even before 1787. As a matter of fact, what I mean is the two factions that you had, the aristocracy, the land, and then you had these merchants. These Founding Fathers were working with the East India Company. There's a book called So Great a Prophet by James Fichter, who discusses that in 1784 until 1787, a lot of those founding fathers became millionaires because they were actually doing business with the East India Company, including Robert Morris, who I believe was in charge at that time. And I really suggest, because I know you're a big East India buff, that you look at the relationship between Robert Morris, Alexander Hamilton, and the East India Company. Because
Hamilton was big on being an industrialist, and he wanted to be a rich guy, and he wanted America to be a big industrial nation. He didn't quite accomplish that. But if you think that these guys were in bed with the East India Company over the long term, or at least past the American Revolution, you are badly mistaken. I mean, in fact, if you think that they were in bed with the East India Company after 1773, when the Boston Tea Party happened, you're badly mistaken, because the Boston Tea Party was the way that these guys rose up against. And you look back, I mean, the year before the Boston Tea Party, Thomas Jefferson was writing, you know, the summary view of the rights of British Americans, right, which was a nice little 30-page pamphlet about how we can be good citizens of the crown. And, you know, then the Boston Tea Party happens, and then the Tea Act, and then the Boston Tea Party, and then the Boston Ports Act, and then the Boston Massacre, and then, you know, Cambridge, and I mean, you know, on and on it goes. Pretty soon, you know, we're having nothing to do with the East India Company. So I beg to differ. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is a really interesting question whether rape should be part of your punishment when you go to prison. And if not, what do we do about it? Daniel Halper is here. He is the online editor with the Weekly Standard. WeeklyStandard.com is the website, and the author of an article basically challenging Obama administration funding that works out to about 1% of our federal prison budget to stop prison rape. And Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me. Just a correction, I am not pro-rape here. You know, I'm not taking the pro-rape approach. All I did was I wrote an article that that analyzed the new rule and the new Department of Justice regulations on these rape rules, and that's all I did. So I'm not taking the pro-rape approach, and I don't think anybody is. I think this is a...
Well, actually, there are a lot of people who do. I was watching a cop show over the weekend, and the guy was like, you know, if you don't go along with this, we're going to stick you in a cell with Bubba. You know what he's going to do. And it wasn't about he's going to beat you up. I mean, you know, everybody gets it. This is the kind of chest-thumping thing. But more rapes were, and these are reported rapes, by the way, and the number of rapes that actually happen in prison that are not reported is probably, you know, huge. But there were more rapes in American prisons last year than there were outside of American prisons. So this is a really big problem. I mean, there's more rape in our prisons than there is outside our prisons. And the Obama administration says, let's take 1% of the prison budget and put into place a whole series of different practices and procedures that range from, you know, how we're watching these people, to how security systems work, to how we decide who is together in a cell, to how we treat people who have been accused of rape, to how we treat people who report rapes. I mean, I didn't know until the Justice Department published these papers and I read them, that right now, if you report a rape that was more than a month old, they can't do anything about it. I mean, you know, and they're saying, well, you know, let's do away with that. And let's do it. It's like, this sounds to me, I mean, 1% of the budget to stop more rape than is happening in the whole United States? How is that a bad thing, Daniel?
I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I think you need to look at, A, the actions that they're suggesting. Take a step back. I think we can both agree that it's a noble cause to root out prison rape, because it's obviously a disgusting thing. If somebody is under state control and in a state or federal prison, and they're essentially giving their life to the government for whatever reason, I think it's incumbent on the government to protect the people that they're holding. I think we can both agree on that. So the question,
and let me make an argument that, I mean, your argument is basically this is too costly. And let me flip that upside down. The rapes that happen in our prisons are costing us more than these regulations will cost in terms of hospitalizations, in terms of HIV infections, in terms of, and that doesn't even begin to measure the non-measurable costs, things like people having PTSD when they leave prison.
That's actually not the argument. I mean, that's one part of the argument. The other element, what I think actually is the most important part, is will these be effective? And there's no actual indication will this be effective. Moreover, there's actually no benchmark set by the Justice Department to actually determine whether this rule, the most expensive rule in the Obama administration Justice Department, whether or not it will actually be effective. So there's a whole slew of regulations. You expand the scope of the government in the prisons, and you expand the way it's done, again, to achieve a noble cause goal, we can both agree, but there's actually no way to measure whether or not these will be effective, and there's a big question as to whether or not these are the proper regulations that would even root out such a horrible thing like prison rape.
Why do you think Daniel, that the federal prison system and the people who work within it are not opposed to these measures? In fact, they're embracing them. It is the private for-profit prison corporations and their lobbyists who are quoting the same kind of rhetoric that you're using.
I don't think that's quite right. Look, I think I think it is.
They're saying you're going to reduce our profitability by setting these standards for how we treat people so that rape doesn't happen in our prisons.
So wait, if you're considering whether or not an incident was motivated by hate, is that going to root out rape in prison? Because that's one of the 43 different action items that the federal government is.
It may well. Here. It may well. You've got a boiler room, what do you call it, a boiling situation. you've got people under incredible pressure in prison, and yes, absolutely. There's a psychological dimension to this.
Tom, you're also ignoring a key fact, which is that rape, of course, is already illegal. So these are prisoners, and I'm obviously generalizing here, but prisoners tend to be people who do not respond to to what we consider rational incentives. So, for instance,
some prisoners.
Why do a lot of people not commit crimes? Because A, it's immoral, or B, because of the consequences, you'll end up in prison. These are not people in general who respond to those sorts of rational things. So you can
not necessarily. Most people who are in prison are going to get out at some point, and they want to get out sooner than later. There is a small number of total whack jobs. You're absolutely right. And those are the people who, by and large, end up in solitary confinement. But, again, to the point, the private for-profit prison industry is opposed to these regulations. The federal prisons are just fine with them. They're like, yeah, let's stop prison rape. I don't understand why anybody would come down on the side of the for-profit prison industry. In fact, I think that this is a sterling example of why we should never turn our commons, particularly our prisons, over to for-profit corporations who are more interested in the bottom line than whether or not one of their people gets HIV.
Are you disturbed that there's no way to measure the effectiveness of this rule in prisons across the nation?
No, I'm not. And I both know that over time, this is federal money being spent over time. If it is demonstrated that these are ineffective, you're going to have, Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell or somebody is going to be standing on the floor of the Senate doing a William Proxmire on this. We both know it.
If you're going to implement and create the largest and most expensive Department of Justice rule, don't you think the burden of proof should be on proving that it's effective?
It is less expensive than what it is going to stop. No, that's like saying, can you prove to me that we're going to go to the moon before John Kennedy says we're going to put together an infrastructure to go to the moon?
No, but you create a spaceship that you know and that you have reasonable expertise to determine that it can reach the moon.
When Kennedy laid that out, everybody said it was impossible. You can't do that in a decade.
Well, the decade that
and it'll cost a fortune, by the way. Barry Goldwater was opposed to it.
This was also laid out a decade ago by President Bush. This is a Bush rule. The problem is that nobody's come out with a smart, creative way to figure out how to solve this problem. The analysis that I reported on suggests that these new regulations are not the smart, late.
Have you read the there's a 74 or 78 page PDF of this over at the DOJ's website that you can print out, and it has all the different categories of who has to do what and what we're going to look at. You know, I spent a couple hours reading that thing last week. It seems pretty rational and straightforward, Daniel. Have you read it?
It's actually 260, this pre-publication report, which I saw, which is 268 pages long. And look, there are...
We must be looking at different reports.
I'm not against the whole thing. I'm not against the idea behind it. The question, again, is effectiveness. That's with all these...
But you won't know until you do it. What would you do instead to stop more rapes than happen in the entire United States?
Well, I think if your goal is strictly to stop rape, regardless of cost, obviously you isolate prisoners, right? I mean, that would be the most...
Give everybody their own cell.
Yeah, you give everyone their own
cell. The for-profit prison corporations will not allow that.
Of course, because it's incredibly expensive. It's not a reasonable way. So, I mean...
Well, I think it's reasonable.
I just don't see how there's a cost-effective way... to do that.
We're talking about human lives here.
Look, we can all agree this is bad. We should root it out, but I think more creative, more thoughtful things.
Daniel Halper, weeklystandard.com. You can read all about it there. Thank you, Daniel.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what would you suggest we do to stop prison rape? We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harvard here with you. And Lee in Wademan, Michigan. Hey, Lee, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yes, on the 21st, just 4 days ago, you had Alan Grayson on.
Yeah.
And he talked about the insurance companies can only take 20% profit.
Right, under Obamacare.
For the premiums, and the other 80% has to go for the actual cost of the premiums, or cost of
medical care. Yes.
And also, you mentioned that.
What's your point?
The point is, all we're hearing is $235,000 or $1 million worth of TV ads have been paid for by the insurance companies. All you hear is negative propaganda about the Obamacare.
Right. The insurance companies don't like it that Obamacare has forced them to actually spend 80% of the dollars that they collect from you and me to take care of people. Now, Medicare, by the way, spends 97% of all the dollars that they collect taking care of people. They only have a 3% administrative overhead. But United Healthcare and Aetna and Blue Cross and all these other companies, they want to have, you know, they want to go back to the days when they had 30-35% that they could play with. And, you know, pay their CEOs $1 billion and have private corporate jets and all that other, you know, but right now Obamacare says, no, you can only take 20% of that zillions of dollars. It's actually trillions, I think.
And you also mentioned that unless you make over $88,000 a year, you will be saving money under Obamacare.
That's correct.
And
assuming that you have health insurance right now, if you have no health insurance, then and you're making under $88,000, then you know it probably won't have much impact on you, except for the fact that you'll have health insurance. If you are making more than that and you don't have health insurance, that's the one area where you end up coughing up some money. But hey, if you're making more than that and you don't have health insurance, you're crazy.
That's true. Yeah, and you also mentioned here that President Obama raised taxes on individuals making over $250,000. Per year, which applies to doesn't apply to the first $250,000.
Well, it's not even an income tax. It's a tax. Well, arguably, I suppose capital gains taxes are income taxes, but it's a tax. It's an addition to the capital gains tax. And the capital gains tax right now is at a historic low. It's at 15%, which is obscene. The Mitt Romney, who makes his living through what are called, you know, capital gains and carried interest, is dumped into that category of capital gains. That he only pays 15% maximum income tax rate on $10-20 million a year in income is just wrong. And so, you know, to pay for Obamacare, they're going to, you know, take another, you know, fragment of a percent out of the hide of people who are making over $250,000 in the category of capital gains that would be normally taxed at a maximum of 15%. That seems to me like, you know, just the very, very smallest of measures. But Lee, thank you for the call and thanks for raising the topic. Charles in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I just want to go back to the Citizens United thing again. I just have a question. You know, assuming that we couldn't get a constitutional amendment passed, and maybe Obama, let's just say he gets to replace either Scalia or perhaps Kennedy, so maybe the balance of power shifts. Then how would we go about reversing Citizens United in that case? I mean, would some state have to pass a law again, and then it would have to go through the whole system again, or how would that work?
The only two ways that I know of to reverse Citizens United that have any possibility of actually happening. I mean, there's more exotic ways, like, you know, Congress could re-regulate the Supreme Court in a way that might conceivably change things. But, you know, the bottom line is, one, you get around it with a constitutional amendment, which is, you know, has been done over and over and over again in the history of the United States. And, you know, where you say, okay, these are the new rules, guys. You know, you have to enforce them. And, you know, which is something that I think is a very good idea. And the second is to change the composition of the Supreme Court, which means wait a few years until one of those five right-wing crazies, you know, retires or dies, and you replace them with somebody who's not as crazy as them. That's going to assume that Mitt Romney's not sitting in the White House.
And once that happens, I mean, then does it require the Congress to pass another law?
No. All the Supreme Court would have to do is take any case that's even peripheral to Citizens United, and I guarantee you there's probably, you know, 300-400 of them a year knocking on their door. Take any of those cases and just say, okay, we will hear that case, and then use that as a lever, as an excuse to just knock down Citizens United. They could do that.
And it seems like this court has just done so much damage. I mean, then they could assumingly go back and change a whole bunch of these terrible decisions that the Supreme Court has rendered, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. This is, you know, not unlike, you know, Brown v. Board, or not unlike Roe v. Wade or whatever. I mean, you get these very kind of moment-changing decisions, and thank you for the call, Charles. You get these moment-changing decisions, and then all the repercussions come after that. Raj in L.A. Hey, Raj, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I got 2 points. One is the decision, Supreme Court, and also a little bit of East India, I will say later. Yeah, the decision today was, do you know it was 5-3? Because Elena Kagan excused herself.
Right.
And what happened was Anthony Kennedy moved to the liberal side. So then it was like 4-4. Then Roberts, I think he moved to the Kennedy side to make it 5-3.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it happened. And about the East India Company, you know, a lot of people don't know how the British came to India. Actually, the British government or the Queen or the royalty, nobody came. There was this guy, his name was Robert Clive. He was an outcast in England. He was robbing banks. They put him in jail. He will come out and rob banks again. So then they told him to leave the country. So he got on a boat and he landed in India. And he made friends with the kings at the time, Rajas in India. And then this news reached England that this guy has befriended India, the kings, and
he'd opened the door. Opened the door. An amazing story, Raj. Thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for watching. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. By the way, in our third hour today, is the U.S. going to be selling ad space on the dollar bill soon? You're going to be amazed by this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to know, first of all, about that Supreme Court decision where speech is money.
Yeah. Well, money is speech, actually, the other way around.
But it's got the same rights as a person, right?
No, the corporation does. And they're not all the same rights. It's just some. And actually, that's even a tortured interpretation of it, because the real way that Citizens United came about, you know, giving corporations rights of persons, is really what they said is that we as people, can't be denied the opportunity to be informed about important matters of public interest. And corporations are really, really useful sources of information. In fact, probably the most useful sources of information about what's going on in the corporate sphere. And therefore, our right to hear would be harmed if their right to speak was limited.
Well, according to Romney, corporations are people too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they have their people. How come they don't reproduce?
Yeah, actually, they do.
In a vaginal manner.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, then you can have the same rights as I do.
Right, give me some birth pains here. Well
and
said, Corky.
You can pay corporation support when you break up the company.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, give them all the same rights.
Child support for former employees, right.
That's why I cannot stand the hypocrisy. And you said about Assange, how can he be tried for treason? He's not even a citizen of the U.S.
Well, I'm not sure that treason would be the word that they would use to apply to what he has done, but the espionage certainly is, and you can go after people who are not citizens for that. And
but you can't go after them for treason.
Well, you know, I don't know. What I do know is that we interviewed at some length, and Corky, thanks for the call. You can watch the interview over at TomHartmann.com. Last week we had a long interview with Michael Ratner, who is one of Julian Assange's attorneys. And he basically said, you know, the United States government, federal government, is building a case against Assange, or it certainly looks like it, that could have a death penalty associated with it. And Assange is scared to death of coming here because he doesn't want to get the Bradley Manning treatment. And, you know, and he doesn't, he thinks as a journalist who put together a website where he was not, knowledgeable about the information that was going up, that he's not culpable. So, you know, time will tell, courts will tell, the court of public opinion will tell, but that's where it's at right now. Nate in Minneapolis. Hey, Nate, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, let me tell you, man, if you don't lie to me at least and give me some good news that like a banker has accidentally walked off the roof of his bank and died horribly, you're going to hear a loud pop, and then my old lady's going to scream, oh, my God, he shot himself. Hey, man,
hey,
did you see Jamie Dimon the other day?
Yeah, yeah. The good news is that
the man never got sworn in.
That's right. He didn't get sworn in. He didn't get sworn in because Spencer Baucus was the guy who was in charge of the committee that in the House of Representatives, Republican Spencer Baucus, who would have sworn him in. And Spencer Baucus's second largest lifetime donor is J.P. Morgan Chase, which is Jamie Dimon's bank.
By the gods, there is only one decent corporation on this planet to me right now, and those are the makers of Zoloft to end this depression. and let me tell you one other thing, man. You jump over to RT, and now you got me watching that BS loony Max Kaiser, and what's so scary is every time I watch him, I go, I think that guy's right.
Yeah, Max seems like he's off the edge sometimes, and there are a lot of things that I disagree with Max about, but there's a lot of things where he's talking about the stuff no one else is talking about.
Overly theatrical, but I'm seeing a Soviet Union style crash, and we talked about this before. And the only thing keeping me truly sane is my love of comic books, man. You know that sense that you could save the world in tights and a cape. That's the only thing I have left. The way these oligarchs and whack jobs they call themselves politicians up in Washington, D.C., are literally just going to sit by with smiles on their faces and watch one of the great experiments in liberty and freedom run itself right into the ground. And I say that to you as a former fighting man of the United States, man.
Well, Nate,
they literally let this country just collapse under their own greed.
I think that there's some good news in all of this. And in fact, I'm frankly pleased that the Supreme Court did not partially reverse itself today on Citizens United. And instead
really?
Stood with that. Yeah, because if they had said that, yeah, okay, Montana has a point. There's some corruption associated with this. We're going to dial it back 10%. It would have taken the steam out of the movement. You know, ask yourself, Nate, just a really simple question. What was it that Lyndon Johnson had that allowed him to do the Great Society and that Franklin Roosevelt had that allowed him to create the New Deal?
So,
what was it that they had that other presidents don't have?
The intensity of bad circumstances. Is that what you're saying, basically?
That's the cause. That's the trigger. But the real thing that they had was they had social movements. There is no way Lyndon Johnson could back down Martin Luther King, and there was no way that Franklin Roosevelt could back down the occupiers of the Bonus Army. There was just no way.
I'm going to set it down here.
Say it again.
I say I'm going to cock the gun and set it down here then, because maybe that is a reason to hold it. If it gets
absolutely
bad enough, people start moving and then things start changing.
And that's the lesson of history. And the big lesson in history, Nate, is that it is not the president. You know, Lyndon Johnson was a very, very screwed up and flawed guy. He was a right wing cracker in Democratic clothing coming out of Texas early on in his career. He came to the presidency he was the head of the Senate, and he was famous for slapping people around and knocking people down.
And one last question.
But he had to respond to the people. He had to respond to the people. That's what we've got to do. We've got to be out there in a way that President Obama or President Romney or whoever it may be can do nothing other than say, okay, you got me. We're going to get it done.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Nate. Thank you very much. Because that's where it's got to go. It's not we've got to get the right president, although it's a good thing to do. And you know, the idea of President Romney scares the hell out of me, mostly because of the Supreme Court. But if the movement of the people is strong enough, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. It's going to happen. Bob, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to tell you right up front, I'm a seeker of knowledge. It's a drug to me, and you've made me an addict. I love your knowledge,
well,
and
thank you.
I appreciate what you do. There's nobody that answers the questions or has the knowledge that the other ones have. You're the only one out there, and thank God. And I just wanted to say,
thank you. I think I have some really good peers, but nonetheless,
sure.
that's not
Citizens
what you called about.
United. I will just say one thing about New World Order.
Sure, George Herbert Walker Bush's phrase. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, do I have this right that you were in prison, Bob?
I was, and I can tell you, I was in Nebraska State Pen.
Mm-hmm.
And for a short time, thank God. And I looked around. You know, you could go to the gym, go to the BDR to eat and that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, you know, there's rape in prison. Where's this going on? I don't see it in the gym and in the bathroom at the gym. Where's this going? And then I had this guy that was flaky, and he goes, hey, man, I know this guy. He wants you to get a hobby card. You know, make some stuff for him. I go, what? I go, who? And then it dawned on me, because I used to play chess in the middle of the yard. And I had a guy I played a lot of chess with, and I remember him, you know, getting all weird one day, going, man, I got to get to the hobby shop. They have a hobby shop, and that's where it goes on. Now, if you want to get rid of rape in a prison, hidden cameras.
Okay.
Hidden cameras.
That's actually a large part.
All they've got to do.
That's a large part of what was in the federal response, and this is one of the more expensive things, is radically increase the number of places and areas in a prison where there are cameras that are observing people. And you know, as I pointed out, the private prison corporations don't want to do it. It's expensive. Somebody's got to install the cameras. Somebody has to maintain them. Somebody has to watch them. I mean, you know, holy cow, that's going to cost money.
The only other option, and this is going to sound, you know, bad, is segregate the prisons, because I can tell you it was only the Africans that were doing it, and they're organized. I mean, there's guys doing 250 years. We used to call them bush jumpers.
Yeah, but it is not, Bob, thanks for the call, but it's hard for me to contradict your experience because you've been in prison and I haven't, but I would be astounded if white people were not committing rape in prison. I mean, I would just be astounded. And, in fact, I'm not willing to believe that, that they're not. You know, I think this has to be an absolutely – this is not a racial issue. John in Portland. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, we're a bit culturally dimmer for your being in the East Coast, but we miss you a lot here.
Well, thank you. We got a minute to the break. John, what's
hangover.
Up?
I'm calling about Jamie Dimon was required to testify the way he is. CEOs now are required to maximize profits for their shareholders no matter what. This came, and the Citizens United came out of they made a faux documentary that was bashing Hillary, and they really just wanted to run the ads.
Right.
And that's what allowed the unlimited funds for the corporations. But there was another suit a few years earlier where a CEO had given some money for a benevolent cause, and shareholders didn't like that. And the Supreme Court ruled that the CEO has a single mission, and that is to maximize shareholder returns. So if shareholders...
Do you know the name of that case? Because my understanding is that was decided by the Michigan Supreme Court in Dodge v. Ford back in the 1930s.
There's one thing I want to add before you cut me off there, Tom, that shareholders could write today and say, don't use our money for political stuff.
Right.
Use our money for, and that way shareholders could drive the move now. We wouldn't have
sure.
to wait for a Supreme
yeah.
Court.
Good luck, though, getting a majority of the shareholders. But if you can come up with that Supreme Court decision, I would love to know. I honestly am saying, I don't think it's been, you know, the federal court has ever said that. But if they have, inform me. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, is the United States going to be selling advertising space on the dollar bill? Really? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And this report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today? We heard the news from the Supreme Court. Shane is reporting for the Talk Radio News Service, I believe, now, right? Shano?
Yes,
sir.
Indeed.
He was there for you guys this morning.
And so have you heard about all three decisions?
I think so.
Immigration, juveniles, mandatory life, and the Montana Citizens United decision.
Yes. Yes, we've covered the three of them.
Okay. Well, what's interesting now as we move on is the two candidates for the president have responded and have issued statements about them.
Oh, well, Romney finally came out and said something?
Well, he said something, but what it was, it was not very clear,
mm-hmm.
put it that way, because he said he believed each state has the duty and the right to secure our borders and preserve the rule of law, particularly when the federal government has failed to meet its responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
He said a bit more, but it was all fluff.
Yeah.
So then the press tried to get his press spokesman, Rick Gawker, to explain what that meant in a lengthy Q&A on the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So he kept saying the governor supports the state's rights to craft immigration laws. So the question was, so does he think it's wrongly decided supports the state's rights to do this? It's a 10th Amendment issue. So he thinks it's constitutional. States have the right to craft. What does he think about the parts invalidated, what Arizona has done and what other states have done? Does he support the law as it was drafted, supports the rights of states? Does he have a position on the law or no position? Has his own immigration policy. He didn't lay one out in Orlando. Does he have a position on the law? But does the law does very specific things. Does the governor support those things that the Arizona law does? We've addressed this. Well, what is his position on the actual law? Again, each state has the right within the Constitution. But what does he think about the law in Arizona? You're just talking about the state's right. Is it fair to say that he has no opinion on the Arizona law? You're not answering. What does he think about the policy in Arizona? Is it fair to say he has no opinion? You're refusing to give us an answer. And then they all exploded.
Wow. Who all exploded? The reporters or the Romney people?
The reporters exploded.
Oh. Now, is Romney saying that states unilaterally have the right to create their own immigration policies and enforce them? Because that would mean, I think, that Arizona could keep people from California out.
I think we can clearly say, Tom, that we have no idea what he's saying.
I mean, if states are sovereign, they can say, hey, we're Arizona. We don't want any of those damn Californians in here.
I mean, he's saying it's a 10th Amendment issue and that they have a right to craft immigration laws when the federal government has failed to do so.
Didn't we already litigate this with something called the Civil War?
Yes, and the fact is that the 10th Amendment wasn't an issue in this case.
Right.
It wasn't about that. And all he said was that each state has the duty and the right to secure our borders and preserve the rule of law. And this is the problem when you have a candidate who refuses to take a position on anything. All he said last week in this policy that Gawker, or whatever his name is, said he laid out was he said to the elected and appointed officials, Hispanics, that we will have a long-term solution. That was the full extent of his policy statement.
Now, here's what I would say about what you have pointed out, Victoria Jones, about how Mitt Romney is refusing to take any position on pretty much anything because it might be controversial, and President Obama is taking positions on things. Let me give you a metaphor or an analogy. Robert Bork and John Roberts.
Yes.
You know,
indeed.
Mitt Romney is doing the John Roberts, Sam Alito strategy. Don't say anything, waffle, equivocate, and play humble. And then once you're in office, do whatever you damn well please. Whereas Robert Bork came right out and said, yeah, I think, you know, this and that and the other thing. And here, and furthermore, I even think that. And everybody went, you do? And we can't put you on the Supreme Court. Robert Bork was a moderate compared to John Roberts. But John Roberts just didn't tell us.
Right. And Romney is hoping he can get away with this until November. And I think the question is, will the press and the public, but the question is, will the press allow him to? And I think they were starting to get so cross today before they exploded that, but at some point they're not going to allow him to. And then the question is, will the debate moderators allow him to?
Now, now you said the press exploded, excuse me. Do you mean that?
Little bits.
In other words, was this the point at which they decided, okay, that's it, we're going to change the topic, or was this the point at which they ended?
No, I mean, I was being metaphoric. The conversation continued until the guy said, well, we're out of time. I mean, he just stonewalled, and if he is the press spokesman, I'm going to sell shoes.
Now, was this the press corps that follows Romney? I know that there are people who are kind of like embedded with the Romney campaign, and they tend to be more generous and friendly toward the candidate than the press corps that doesn't follow the candidate. So if he's got his own, you know, his own friendlies attacking him, I mean, they're not partisan friendlies, but there's a certain amount of, you know, hale hearty good fellow that goes on.
Yeah.
You know, probably the first person to point that out was Hunter S. Thompson back writing about the Nixon campaign. But if he's got his own press corps upset, he's got a big problem, doesn't he?
He's getting to have a problem partly because of lack of access, because he doesn't talk to the press, he ignores them. Then he shuts them out of events.
Mm-hmm.
And now because he just will not state a policy on anything. There's a 5-page piece in Politico today about Romney not taking positions on the issues.
Right.
And this has been going on for some considerable time. He hopes he can get away with it till November. I'm not sure in this particular 24-hour news cycle that he can.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see, particularly given that in the past he's been on every side of every issue. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. And coming up next, is the United States totally for sale? Are we going to see ExxonMobil logos on our dollar bills? Really? Really?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, through the history of America, books, movies, TV shows, Twilight Zone episodes, they've all often tried to paint a picture of what our future might look like. Right? Some, like George Orwell's iconic book 1984, envision a dystopic Big Brother government ruling over all of us. You know, others like, did you see The Hunger Games? It's a pretty incredible movie. It's about a future very much like feudal times. You know, those good old days that the conservatives want to go back to, where the nation's run by a small and very, very wealthy elite who pluck children from the vast working class poor to duel to the death in a televised contest. I mean, they didn't have television back in feudal days, but it was essentially the same. And then, of course, there are those futurists like Jefferson, de Tocqueville, Lincoln, and FDR who imagined a nation of the people, by the people, for the people. I think it still remains to be seen whether the future belongs to Big Brother, or to the super rich, or to we the people. But we're already catching a glimpse of a dystopia, by the way. It's like utopia is good, you know, dystopia nasty, okay? And frankly, it's an absurd future America in which corporations run or own virtually everything we see and do every single day all around the nation. This is the future where all our commons, you know, that stuff owned by we the people, school buses, fire trucks, police cars, public libraries, parks, road signs, subways, all of it has been hijacked by corporations and ad men. In the not-too-distant future, and already in some places around America, corporate advertising runs everything. Take, for example, a fire hydrant in Indiana, now belongs to Kentucky Fried Chicken, or manhole covers, now belong to Colonel Sanders. The New York Times explained what's going on here with a recent article about how broke cities, afraid to raise their taxes on the rich or the corporate residents, are instead selling naming rights to those same corporations they're afraid to tax. The article looks at the cash-strapped city of Baltimore, which just passed a resolution clearing the way for corporations to begin advertising, get this, on fire trucks. So now when firefighters come to save your house from being burned down, fire truck could be brought to you by Bank of America, who at the very same time may well be trying to foreclose on the very same burning house. As the New York Times writes, Baltimore is joining dozens of other financially struggling cities, transit systems, and school districts around the country that are trying to weather the economic downturn by selling advertisements, naming rights, and sponsorships to raise money. You know, it's really predictable. After 30 years of Reaganomics and starve the beast of government tax policies, corporations, which use our commons more heavily than do ordinary citizens, used to pay about a third of federal revenue for the use of those commons, from our courts to having an educated workforce to having police and fire protection. Today, after 30 years of Reaganomics, they pay less than 9%. And it's become politically impossible to raise taxes anymore to close budget gaps. So instead, lawmakers are having to raise revenue by selling off what's left of our commons to corporate advertisers. For example, in Philly, Philadelphia transit system fare cards now have McDonald's advertising on them. And the metro station, formerly known as Patterson Station, is now called the AT&T Station. Several states have now passed laws to allow corporate advertisers to buy space on school buses. Right, school buses. And turn them into moving billboards to entice them to eat Little Caesars pizza. Or school buses that are advertising, and there's actually one doing it, a local car dealer. Since, after all, kids who ride a bus to school must need their own car, right? Or you just want to brand imprint them so that when they do need their own car, they'll know who to go to. In Syracuse, New York, police rescue helicopters are getting the corporate advertising treatment, too. John Baloney, a chief in the local sheriff's department, said about the move, "Some people are a little put off by the idea that we're getting sponsorship for what used to be a government duty." You think? Question is, where will this end? Right? How long until our police cars are advertising for home security companies so that distressed burglary victims can be sold on a new home alarm system when the cops show up? How long before the cops start taking the orders? How long until our money is stacked with corporate advertising when Goldman Sachs can print its logo on a $20 bill with a slogan that says, "Invest this here"? In fact, you could argue that there's already corporate advertising on our money. It's that private bank called the Federal Reserve Bank. How long until our public parks are littered with billboards for natural gas fracking companies, convincing tourists that the park will be, oh, just as beautiful with the fracking wells all over. Isn't that pretty? How long until speed limit signs are advertising the newest Ford or Chevy sports car flaunting how it can reach the speed limit in less than 6 seconds? This stop sign brought to you by BMW. How long until Penn Station in New York or Union Station here in Washington, D.C. get renamed after corporate sponsors and become ExxonMobil Station and Blue Cross Blue Shield Station? Hey, it started with stadiums. And you paid for the stadiums, too. Is this the sort of future that we want, where everything that used to belong to we the people now belongs to a corporate sponsor? Where we can't leave our house, go to school, ride an ambulance, call a fire department, without being hit on by corporations telling us what insurance policy we should buy, what pizza we should order, and whether or not we should get our fried chicken extra crispy or original recipe? This is this dystopia I've described to you. Of course, the world envisioned by Ayn Rand and all her Brave New World buddies like Alan Greenspan and Paul Ryan and apparently Antonin Scalia. But frankly, to paraphrase Antonin Scalia, in my opinion, if the founders had heard such a proposal, they would have run for the exits. So how long is it going to be? We have corporations that have gone from paying a third of the bill in their taxes for the commons of the United States, which they use more than half of. They've gone from paying a third of the bill down to paying less than a tenth of the bill. And so the cities and townships and counties and states, they're broke. I mean, you got tax collections are down right now because of the Great Bush recession. And this 30 years of Reaganomics and Republicans bowing down and kissing the butt of Grover Norquist and signing pledges to him in blood that say, I will never vote to raise taxes on rich people, has rendered the whole concept of paying for the commons with common money, with the money of the people who are using them, null and void. Right? I mean, they squeezed as much out of the average working person as they can, but they're afraid to go to the corporation. You know, you guys used to pay 30%. You guys used to pay a third of the cost of government. Now you're paying a tenth of the cost of government. We'd like you to pay a little more. After all, you corporations, you use our courts. It's more than half of our courts are used by corporations. Our schools turn out educated students for you. Our roads, you transport your goods and services over and your employees get there. Our police protect your factories and your offices. Our fire departments look over them. Our rescue squads are there to help you out. I mean, come on, guys. Cough up. And, oh, no, can't do that. That would upset the Koch brothers. That would upset, you know, multimillionaire lobbyist Dick Armey and his Tea Party group. Can't do that. I'm just astounded, by the way, by how many of these don't tread on me flags I'm seeing around. We'll get back to that rant in a few minutes. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back in about 4.5 minutes here with more on this topic and your thoughts on it as well. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option. And Congressman Charles Gonzalez is with us, a member of the United States Congress representing the 20th District of Texas. Sir, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I should say your website, Gonzalez with a Z, .house.gov. And you have some thoughts about the Supreme Court's ruling here today on Arizona Senate Bill 1070. I'd love to hear.
Well, sure, Tom. I think it made it real clear that immigration is a federal issue and that the states can't basically create crimes when it comes to immigration law and try to enforce those type of state provisions, which, of course, Arizona was the leader in doing that and adopted by others. We are all concentrating, and I know the comments are on that one part or that one provision, which was not held unconstitutional. But I think what the Supreme Court, in essence, was saying, it's premature to pass on it.
Right.
But we've always felt that that probably was going to be the outcome because Chief Justice Roberts, at the outset of oral argument, said, hey, we're not here to discuss profiling, are we? We're not here about racial or ethnic profiling, are we? And definitely that wasn't the issue before them. So we always knew that was to be visited at a later time, and it will be, and that part will be held unconstitutional.
Right. So Mitt Romney today, in response to a series of reporters' questions,
repeated this mantra of 10th Amendment, states have the rights to protect their borders. My understanding was that, first of all, the 10th Amendment doesn't give states the rights to protect their borders, and that secondly, the last time states were asserting the right to protect their borders, we litigated that, and the states lost. It was called the Civil War.
Well, actually, I mean, these are echoes from the past, and that's unfortunate because it tells you the direction the country has taken, and it's very dangerous, and we need to be very, very careful. Where Mitt Romney, and the reason that he has to say that is because he can't walk back from positions that he took during that presidential primary. He right. said SB 1070 was a model. But beyond that, if you remember, he also said, if I were president, I would not be contesting any of these state laws, such as 1070. So if you had a Romney administration, you probably would have 50 different type immigration laws, depending on what state you were in.
In your opinion, is that constitutional or legal?
Of course not. And you can't have it. You simply can't have it. And as far as saying that this is the way a state protects itself, this goes way beyond that particular concern. Rather than coordinating and maximizing federal and state resources, you have something else going on here, and I think people are on to it. And I know that Governor Brewer is trying to characterize this as a victory. I'll tell you this, I would not want her to negotiate anything in my behalf and come back and tell me we just won when we lost three-fourths of a case. And so that's the situation you're facing. It's all about politics. But it goes way beyond presidential year politics or anything like that. It is about policy. It's about wrong policy by certain states that is being embraced by Mr. Romney.
I'm curious your thoughts on Justice Scalia. And I understand there's a separation of power between the branches. Perhaps you'd rather not step into this. But he went off on the president today by name, or at least by title. And
Tom, look, I think you're going to agree on this, knowing some of your history and your appreciation for checks and balances, for the separation of powers, decorum, respect, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never seen anything like this. I mean, I am a lawyer by training. I was a state district judge for many years. I mean, I don't know where, you know, some sort of judicial restraint comes in many forms. One of them is how you basically promote and how you present that branch of government. And it has to be respectful and with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
What Scalia did today and what I've read, I just don't understand what would possess a Supreme Court justice to make those kind of comments. We don't need that kind of debate coming from the Supreme Court.
Well, I would submit that this is the most partisan Supreme Court we've seen since 1936. But I may be wrong. I don't know, and I'm not looking for an agreement on that. I just that's my assertion. But what do we do? Senate Bill 1070 is symptomatic of something much larger, which is the fact that ever since Reagan's amnesty and then Reagan stopped enforcing the laws against employers hiring people who are not in this country legally, we've seen this growth of what the right refers to as illegal immigration. But no prosecution of what I refer to as illegal employers or exploitative employers. And in the midst of this whole milieu, we've got all these people who, the children who didn't make any choice at all, people who are simply trying to make a better life, some people who are, criminals and exploiting a broken system. I mean, isn't it time for us to have a national conversation that's rational about this, that isn't loaded with race-baiting rhetoric, and come to some sort of comprehensive immigration reform?
Tom, I've been in Congress 14 years. We've been begging for comprehensive immigration reform. We used to have a few Republicans on board. We've lost all of them. Because there's no political advantage, or even in fairness, they're not willing to touch it. But you're exactly right. There are 11 million undocumented workers and their families. Many of them, of course, have been here in excess of 15 years. They actually are an economic necessity and in our best interest. I mean, this is so obvious, but something else is going on in this country, and it is not a healthy development. And it would be wonderful if Mr. Romney would simply say, let's do that, which is in our own best interest, try to get people to assimilate into mainstream American life, mm-hmm. which is something that comprehensive immigration promotes and tries to establish, that right. proficiency in English, make sure you don't have a criminal record, you pay your taxes,
yep.
That you're employed. All of those things that are, in essence, really American.
Right, and also takes away the ability of unscrupulous employers to exploit people and threaten them with, you know, revealing their undocumented status or that sort of thing. Congressman Charles Gonzalez, gonzalez.house.gov. Sir, thank you so much for dropping by today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great speaking with you. There's a lot going on in this country we need to be addressing. And we need a lot more good congressmen like Mr. Gonzalez.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So where is this corporatization of America leading us, and how do we put a stop to it now? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very, the courteously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, Edison Factor, food for your brain. The good, Bill Robinson. Robinson, the president of the American Bar Association and a large Republican donor, is attacking Senator Mitch McConnell's plan to block every appeals court nominee for the rest of President Obama's term. In a letter to McConnell and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Robinson argues that the majority of nominees pending on the Senate floor have received strong support from the Senate Judiciary Committee and have support from both sides of the aisle and the endorsement of top conservative legal scholars. With a growing number of open spots on the federal bench, America is facing a judicial crisis. And rather than stop the crisis, Mitch McConnell has turned it into a game of petty politics. Let's hope Mr. Robinson can knock some sense into him, metaphorically speaking, of course. The bad, the Vatican. How do you try to rebrand your image after a decade of controversy? Well, if you're the Vatican and Pope Benedict XVI, you hire someone from Fox so-called news to do PR. Vatican has hired Greg Burke, Fox's Rome correspondent, to help create a better communications policy and to improve the church's image around the world. In a statement about the hiring, the Vatican said it is trying, quote, to cope with years of communications blunders and one of its most serious scandals in decades, end quote. I don't know who vetted Burke, but I'm not sure if hiring someone who worked for a misogynistic, homophobic, and racially charged news network was the best way to improve the Vatican's PR problems. And the very, very ugly Congressman Tom Latham. Latham was on a radio show in Iowa over the weekend when the host started talking about a group of Catholic nuns who are traveling the country protesting the budget cuts in Paul Ryan's Republican budget, which they say goes against the values of Catholicism. The host then gave his take on the nuns. The host of the show said that someone should, quote, pull the nuns on the bus over and pistol whip them, end quote. And despite such an outrageous statement, Representative Latham just laughed it off and didn't say a word. Apparently, Congressman Latham thinks it's okay to encourage both violence against women and gun violence, and that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. James in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, James, says you want to disagree with me, so you go right to the front of the line. What's up?
All right, appreciate that. I see that the corporations that are hiding money overseas or not investing in localities anymore, taking jobs every place else, want to put their names on places like the Metro, things that I use, and for the pittance of just putting their name on a ticket or on the outside of the building, they're going to help subsidize my commute, that instead of them putting money in, they're going to shut down my bus lines, they're going to make fewer cars running things. I'd much rather let them put their name on something, take their money so that they're putting back into my community than worry about whether or not it's right or wrong that AT&T or McDonald's has coupons on my Metro ticket.
But you're envisioning a false dichotomy or a false choice. You're saying, you know, you're saying that it's binary, and it's not binary. There's not just two options, one option being you don't take their money, and therefore your city runs out of, you know, their advertising dollars, and therefore your city runs out of money. Or the other being, you do take their advertising dollars, and your city gets a little more money to do things. The third choice is you tax them at the rate that they used to be taxed. You make it illegal for corporations to play one community off against another. Now, you can't pass a law that says they can't do that,
They do it constantly, though. You know, there's corporations all over this country, particularly the large ones, that pay no property taxes. They get multi-million dollar rebates and refunds and all kinds of things. So if you'll just move your factory to our town. You know, remember when Boeing was going to move their headquarters out of Seattle? They had three cities competing with each other. They ended up giving them hundreds of millions of dollars to wherever they ended up. I think it was Chicago. Bernie Sanders suggested that we simply amend the highway bill to say that any state which either the state or any of the counties or cities in that state have negotiated with corporations against other states or counties or cities is no longer eligible for federal highway funds. It would put an end to it tomorrow, and you would see the percentage of corporate revenue supporting our government go from 9% where it is right now. And keep in mind, corporations are costing us well over half of the cost of government, particularly when you include the cost of the military, which is mostly protecting international shipping lanes, especially international oil shipping lanes. ExxonMobil last year made hundreds of billions of dollars and paid nothing in taxes. They're using the commons and they're paying virtually nothing for it. Have them start paying something for it. What's wrong with that?
If they're already escaping these, you can't force them to put that factory back in the U.S. and make them pay taxes. If I've got a few of these companies that are willing to sit there and pay back into my community so that I can ride a bus, in Atlanta right now, they've already shut down 60% of all the bus lines, and we have a third of our MARTA runs. When I left D.C. 2 years ago, they raised the price on a Metro ticket three times in 1 year.
You haven't addressed my question, and you started with a false statement. You said you can't make them bring their jobs back here. What do you think caused American manufacturers to manufacture in America up until the 1980s? Why was it that companies that Levi made Levi's here? Why was it that Hanes made underwear and socks here? Why was it that steel companies made steel here? Why? Do you know why?
That they could afford to pay the workers.
No.
And the workers
no.
More money.
I'm not asking why they left. I'm asking why they stayed here. From the George Washington administration to the Ronald Reagan administration, for 200 years, the companies manufactured things in America. Why didn't they go to places where there were lower taxes? Keep in mind, the corporate taxes during the Eisenhower administration, when companies were not leaving this country, were about four times higher than they are right now. And labor was more well paid during the Eisenhower administration than they are right now. Why did those companies not leave?
How many people paid that much money? What percentage of the rich people were actually paying that much money?
You don't know the answer to my question, do you?
Whether or not the Eisenhower in the Eisenhower administration they were paying more taxes.
Let me restate the question. Why did those companies? Why did companies manufacture goods? James, just listen.
They started here. That's why.
Okay, that's not the reason. The reason why is because when Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury in the George Washington administration, in 1791, George Washington gave him a commission. He said, figure out how to turn America into a great manufacturing power. Now, he did this over the objections of Thomas Jefferson, by the way, who thought we should be a great agricultural power. Hamilton came up with an 11-point plan. You can read it. It's no secret. I based a book on it called Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Steps to Rebuild America. Hamilton came up with an 11-point plan to build, it's called Alexander Hamilton's Report to Congress on American Manufacturers. And it was an 11-point plan that said, number one, we are going to tax at the point of entry into the United States any goods from outside the United States which could be manufactured here. And the tax will be set so that the cost of manufacturing in a foreign basis becomes greater than manufacturing here. In addition to that, he said, we're also going to subsidize emerging industries, and we did. Right up to rail during the Lincoln administration, we would be constantly subsidizing new and emerging industries like the Obama administration is trying to do with solar right now. We're going to subsidize emerging industries, and we're going to penalize companies that go offshore. And as a consequence of that, those taxes that you pay when a product hits the border are called tariffs. As a consequence of that, 100% of all the federal revenue, we had no income tax when this country started, 100% of all the federal revenue from the founding of the Republic in the George Washington administration until the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln put into place the first income tax, 100% of the cost of government was paid for by tariffs. 100%. George Washington's salary, John Adams' salary, Thomas Jefferson's salary, James Madison's salary, James Monroe's salary. We could just go through the whole list. Every member of Congress, the Supreme Court, the government, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, all of it was paid for by tariffs. From the Civil War until World War I, fully two-thirds. In World War I, we were no longer a small agrarian nation. We were a major industrial power. Fully two-thirds of the entire federal budget was paid for with tariffs. Now, this isn't even the corporate income tax. This is tariffs. And from World War I until World War II, it was fully a third of the federal budget. That's why people manufactured here, because we had a trade policy that said if you don't manufacture here and you try to bring something in, it's going to cost you more.
And that's great. But this
so why don't we go back to that?
President, the 43rd and 44th president are not going back to that. That's not you. That's not me. What I can do right now, this year, not in 1861, is I can have somebody pay for half of my Metro ticket so I can get back and forth to work and have enough money left over to go to the store.
You are so willing to settle for, I'm going to beg the poor corporations to give me some money.
What can you change right now that is going to work? You can't do
Ross Perot got 20% of the vote for president of the United States, James, based on this one issue. 20% of the presidential vote. You're telling me that if we can't get enough Americans seriously pissed off about this and out there speaking up that politicians aren't going to hear it and do something about it? This is an issue on which I can agree with the Tea Party.
This is a better 20%. When you get better than 20% approval in Congress so that the president and Congress can get things done, then you and I can talk about how we can reinstate.
Well, if they would start talking about tariffs, they would have a better approval rating. It's really simple, James.
They can't even talk about a fair tax, and I'm not agreeing with a fair tax. They can't talk about
I'm not even talking about taxes. I'm talking about tariffs.
And who do you have on your side right now, progressively or liberal, that is going to help enforce that?
Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, I'd say probably most of the 100 or so members of the Progressive Caucus, virtually all of them signed onto the Progressive budget last year, which got very little publicity, which proposed import tariffs on manufactured goods, which would have brought back a policy that for 200 years protected our manufacturers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to remind folks that out there that tariffs work. You know, you said that Plank and the Progressive Party was eliminated, no media coverage on adding tariffs. Well, something else has occurred in the last year that there's been almost a media blackout, except for a few financial publications. Brazil implemented tariffs on all electronics goods that were not assembled in Brazil.
And Chinese manufacturing companies are building factories in Brazil now.
$2 billion investment by Foxconn, which assembles the iPhone amongst many other things.
Yep.
They built a plant almost immediately to capture that Brazilian market and employed Brazilians. And this, that goes back to one of the CEOs from Intel wrote about this extensively. What they see is not just the jobs, but the training, the on-the-job training, and how many of those assemblers go on to become technicians, or go on to become engineers, and get this kind of training and build a sustainable economy.
Plus,
but
you've
tariffs
got
work.
Excuse me.
Tariffs work, and the empirical evidence is kept from us.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And plus, there's a knock-on effect. I mean, if you build a factory and you hire people and you pay them decently, their kids are now, more likely to succeed in school. You're more likely to have an educated workforce. You're more likely to have an educated populace. They're going to be spending money in their community. The stores are going to thrive and prosper.
It's called the virtuous circle.
Yes.
Yeah, I call it the money wheel. They're both the same. The money goes out in wages. It gets spent in the community. It comes back more business, and it just continues. It's become sustainable. But when you break that circle, and you send that money over to China, And
or anywhere else.
Good over there.
I mean, a lot of it's going to Germany right now.
it's siphoned out of the economy,
yep.
And it doesn't come back. And, I mean, people, it's so simple. Everybody understands this. And that what disgusts me thoroughly in this political cycle is that I'm sorry, but I have not heard any talk of China, very little. I think there was a brief snippet a week or two ago. And everybody knows what the problem is. If you ask them what the problem is, they eventually come to China, and the jobs go into China.
Well, and this is I think the consensus awareness of this among the American people is one of the things that's starting to bite Mitt Romney in the butt, because you know the New York Times had that big piece over the weekend, or last Friday maybe it was, about how he made his chops at Bain by outsourcing jobs, and you know principally to Asia. And Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyhow. Dave, you are absolutely right. Very well said. Thank you for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to quickly string together three notions based on something you said earlier in the show. You talked about how the 1856, or was it 57, Dred Scott decision may have fueled the Civil War. And,
right.
In fact, it absolutely did, because in the debates with Stephen Douglas, Abraham Lincoln actually called Roger B. Taney out by name when he said that a house divided cannot stand. He said, but James, Franklin, Roger, and Stephen are the craftsmen who are constructing a house divided. And what he was talking about was that we can't have a nation wherein states decide civil rights issues for themselves.
Right.
And I think that that's part of what's wrong with the Arizona SB 1070. But I wanted to also say I think it's possible that the Citizens United decision could fuel a type of economic civil war.
I think it already has.
Yeah, it already has. And there's one thing, there's something else I wanted to point out quickly, is that in Federalist Paper 10, Madison argues that factions will fight with factions, and that's how factionalism will be prevented from taking over. But what's happened, I think Madison would be surprised to see how the court's behaving. The Republican Party has become a confederacy of extremist factions, and the Supreme Court is deciding for them.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's essentially what's happened here.
Absolutely. Well said. Thank you very much for the call, right. Paul. Very well said. Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi. I'd like to find out your opinion. Do you see a relationship between what happened to the Native American and what happened to the middle class, in where they lost 40% of their wealth in a rigged system, as described in the documentary Inside Job? And I'll take your response off air. Thank you, Tom.
Sure. Thank you, Jim. Yes, I do. And I see a relationship between that and slavery as well. And you know, years and years of discrimination. And basically what we're looking at is the sociopathic worldview represented by corporations going back to the British East India Company, which is that workers are expendable objects. And you have to ask yourself a really fundamental question. Why do we have an economy? Right? You don't hear much conversation about this. But this is the question. Why do we have an economy? And what the Mitt Romneys of the world would tell you is that we have an economy so that people can get rich. But that's not what the founders envisioned. That's not what, you know, when Madison put his 11-point plan for manufacturers, that's not what he envisioned. That's not what this country was built on. And certainly not what Adam Smith is writing about in Wealth of Nations, and more importantly in his book Theory of Moral Sentiments. Instead, what they were saying is that the reason that our government, we the people, create laws and rules that establish a marketplace, an economy, is because it will benefit all of us. And so the question then becomes, what should the rules of the economy be that will benefit the most people? How about a high a minimum wage so that people have, you know, a decent, a fair, a square deal, as Teddy Roosevelt said? How about, you know, decent work rules? How about the ability to unionize? How about tariffs that will protect our jobs from going offshore? I mean, there's some pretty straightforward stuff that we can do here in the United States, and it's almost all stuff we've done in the past that's worked. It's been undone by transnational corporate wealth and power, much to our detriment. So what's going to stimulate the economy? Could it be raising the minimum wage? I'm going to be debating that tomorrow, by coincidence, with Conservative Phil Kirpin, president of American Commitment, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.